Chapter 1 of He Can Who Thinks He Can. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Kirk Ziegler. He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orison Swett Marden. Chapter 1. He Can Who Thinks He Can.
I promised my God I would do it.
In September 1862, when Lincoln issued his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, the sublimest act of the 19th century, he made this entry in his diary.
I promised my God I would do it.
Does anyone doubt that such a mighty resolution added power to this marvelous man, or that it nerved him to accomplish what he had undertaken? Neither ridicule nor caricature, neither dread of enemies nor desertion of friends, could shake his indomitable faith in his ability to lead the nation through the greatest struggle in its history. Napoleon, Bismarck, and all other great achievers had colossal faith in themselves. It doubled, trebled, even quadrupled the ordinary power of these men. In no other way can we account for the achievements of Luther, Wesley, or Savonarola. Without this sublime faith, this confidence in her mission, how could the simple country maiden, Jeanne d'Arc, have led and controlled the French army? This divine self-confidence multiplied her power a thousandfold, until even the king obeyed her, and she led his stalwart troops as if they were children. After William Pitt was dismissed from office, he said to the Duke of Devonshire,
"I'm sure I can save this country, and that nobody else can."
For 11 weeks, says Bancroft, England was without a minister. At length the king and aristocracy recognized Pitt's ascendancy and yielded to him the reins. It was his unbounded confidence in his ability that compelled the recognition and led to the supremacy in England of Benjamin Disraeli, the once despised Jew. He did not quail or lose heart when the hisses and jeers of the British Parliament rang in his ears. He sat down amid the jeering members, saying,
"You will yet hear me."
He felt within him the confidence of power that made him Prime Minister of England, and turned sneers and hisses into admiration and applause. Much of President Roosevelt's success has been due to his colossal self-confidence. He believes in Roosevelt, as Napoleon believed in Napoleon. There is nothing timid or half-hearted about our great president. He goes at everything with gigantic assurance, with that tremendous confidence which half wins the battle before he begins. It's astonishing how the world makes way for a resolute soul, and how obstacles get out of the path of a determined man who believes in himself. There is no philosophy by which a man can do a thing when he thinks he can't. What can defeat a strong man who believes in himself and cannot be ridiculed down, talked down, or written down? Poverty cannot dishearten him, misfortune deter him, or hardship turn him a hair's breadth from his course. Whatever comes, he keeps his eye on the goal and pushes ahead. What would you think of a young man, ambitious to become a lawyer, who should surround himself with a medical atmosphere and spend his time reading medical books? Do you think he would ever become a great lawyer by following such a course? No, he must put himself in a law atmosphere, go where he can to absorb it and be steeped in it until he is attuned to the legal note. He must be so grafted upon the legal tree that he can feel its sap circulating through him. How long will it take a young man to become successful who puts himself in an atmosphere of failure and remains in it until he is soaked, saturated with the idea? How long will it take a man who depreciates himself, talks failure, thinks failure, walks like a failure, and dresses like a failure, who is always complaining of the insurmountable difficulties in his way, and whose every step is on the road to failure? How long will it take him to arrive at the success goal? Will anyone believe him or expect him to win? The majority of failures begin to deteriorate by doubting or depreciating themselves, or by losing confidence in their own ability. The moment you harbor doubt and begin to lose faith in yourself, you capitulate to the enemy. Every time you acknowledge weakness, inefficiency, or lack of ability, you weaken your self-confidence, and that is to undermine the very foundation of all achievement. So long as you carry around a failure atmosphere and radiate doubt and discouragement, you will be a failure. Turn about face, cut off all currents of failure thoughts, of discouraged thoughts. Boldly face your goal with a stout heart and a determined endeavor, and you will find that things will change for you. But you must see a new world before you can live in it. It is to what you see, to what you believe, to what you struggle incessantly to attain, that you will approximate.
Trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to that iron string.
I know people who have been hunting for months for a situation because they go into an office with a confession of weakness in their very manner. They show their lack of self-confidence. Their prophecy of failure is in their face, in their bearing. They surrender before the battle begins. They are living witnesses against themselves. When you ask a man to give you a position, and he reads this language in your face and manner, "Please give me a position. Do not kick me out. Fate is against me. I am an unlucky dog. I am disheartened. I have lost confidence in myself," he will only have contempt for you. He will say to himself that you are not a man to start with, and he will get rid of you as soon as he can. If you expect to get a position, you must go into an office with the air of a conqueror. You must fling out self-confidence from yourself before you can convince an employer that you are the man he's looking for. You must show by your very presence that you are a man of force, a man who can do things with vigor, cheerfulness, and enthusiasm. Self-reliance, which carries great, vigorous self-faith, has ever been the best substitute for friends, pedigree, influence, and money. It is the best capital in the world. It has mastered more obstacles, overcome more difficulties, and carried through more enterprises than any other human quality. I have interviewed many timid people as to why they let opportunities pass by them that were eagerly seized by others with much less ability, and the answer was invariably a confession like the following. "I have not the courage," said one.
"I lack confidence in myself," said another.
"I shrink from trying, for fear I shall make a mistake, and I shall have the mortification of being turned down," said a third.
"It would look so cheeky for me to have the nerve to put myself forward," said a fourth.
"Oh, I do not think it would be right to seek a place so far above me," said another. "I think I ought to wait until the place seeks me, or I am better prepared."
So they run through the whole gamut of self-distrust. This shrinking, this timidity or self-effacement often proves a worse enemy to success than actual incompetence. Take the lantern in hand, and you will always have light enough for your next step, no matter how dark, for the light will move along with you. Do not try to see the long way ahead. "One step is enough for me." A physical trainer in one of our girls' colleges says that his first step is to establish the girls in self-confidence, to lead them to think only of the ends to be attained and not of the means. He shows them that the greater power lies behind the muscles, in the mind, and points to the fact so frequently demonstrated that a person in a supreme crisis, as in a fire or other catastrophe, can exert strength out of all proportion to his muscle. He thus helps them get rid of fear and timidity, the great handicaps to achievement. I believe if we had a larger conception of our possibilities, a larger faith in ourselves, we could accomplish infinitely more. And if we only better understood our divinity, we would have this larger faith. We are crippled by the old orthodox idea of man's inferiority.
"There is no inferiority about the man that God made. The only inferiority in us is what we put into ourselves. What God made is perfect."
The trouble is that most of us are but a burlesque of the man God patterned and intended. A Harvard graduate, who has been out of college a number of years, writes that because of his lack of self-confidence, he has never earned more than $12 a week. A graduate of Princeton tells us that except for a brief period, he has never been able to earn more than a dollar a day. These men do not dare to assume responsibility. Their timidity and want of faith in themselves destroy their efficiency. The great trouble with many of us is that we do not believe enough in ourselves. We do not realize our power. Man was made to hold up his head and carry himself like a conqueror, not like a slave, as a success, not as a failure, to assert his God-given birthright. Self-depreciation is a crime. If you would be superior, you must hold the thought of superiority constantly in the mind.
a singularly modest man of so retiring a disposition that at one time he did not show half of his great ability, whose shrinking nature and real talent for self-abasement had actually given him an inferior appearance, told me one day how he had encountered this tendency toward self-depreciation. Among other things, he said, he had derived a great benefit from the practice he had formed of going about the streets, especially where he was not known, with an air of great importance, as though imagining himself the mayor of the city, the governor of the state, or even president of the United States, by merely looking as though he expected everybody to recognize that he must be a person of note. He changed not only his appearance, but also his convictions. It raised him immeasurably in his own estimation. It had a marked effect upon his whole character. Where once he walked through the streets, shrinking from the gaze of others, and dreading their scrutiny, he now boldly invites, even demands, attention by his evident superiority, for he has the appearance of one whom people would like to know. In other words, he has caught a glimpse of his divinity. He really feels his superiority, and his self-respecting manner reflects it. Be sure that your success will never rise higher than your confidence in yourself. The greatest artist in the world could not paint the face of a Madonna with a model of depravity in his mind. You cannot succeed while doubting yourself or thinking thoughts of failure. Cling to success thoughts. Fill your mind with cheerful, optimistic pictures, pictures of achievement. This will scatter the specters of doubt and fear and send a power through you which will transform you into an achiever. No matter how poor or how hemmed in you may be, stoutly deny the power of adversity or poverty to keep you down. Constantly assert your superiority to environment. Believe in yourself. Feel that you are to dominate your surroundings. Resolve that you will be the master and not the slave of circumstances. This very assertion of superiority, this assumption of power, this affirmation of your ability to succeed, the attitude that claims success is an inalienable birthright, will strengthen the whole man and give great added power to the combination of faculties which doubt, fear, and lack of confidence undermine. Self-confidence marshals all one's faculties and twists their united strength into one mighty achievement cable. It carries conviction. It makes other people believe in us. What has not been accomplished through its miraculous power? What triumphs in invention, in art, and in discovery have been wrought through its magic? What does not civilization owe to the invincible self-faith of its inventors, its discoverers, its railroad builders, its mine developers and city builders? It has won 1,000 victories in science and in war which were deemed impossible by faint-hearted doubters. The fact that you believe implicitly that you can do what may seem impossible or very difficult to others shows that there is something within you that has gotten a glimpse of power sufficient to do the thing. Many men who have achieved great things cannot account for their faith. They cannot tell why they had the implicit confidence that they could do what they undertook. But the result was evidence that something within them had gotten a glimpse of latent, resourceful, reserve power and possibilities which would warrant that faith. And they have gone ahead, often when they could not see a ray of light, with implicit confidence that they would come out all right, because this faith told them so. It told them so because it had been in communication with something within them that was divine, that which had passed the bounds of unlimited and entered the domain of the limitless. When we begin to exercise the faculties of self-faith, self-confidence, we are stimulating and increasing the strength of the very faculties which enable us to do the thing we have set our hearts on. The very exercise of faith helps us to do what we undertake, because our greater concentration develops that portion of the brain which enables us to accomplish it. Men who have left their mark on the world have often been implicit followers of their faith when they could see no light, and their faith has led them through the wilderness of doubt and hardship into the promised land. Our faith often tells us that we may proceed safely, even in the dark, when we see no light ahead. Faith is a divine leader, which never misdirects us. We must only be sure that it is faith and not merely egotism or selfish desire. Our faith puts us in touch with the infinite, opens the way to unbound possibilities, limitless power. It is the truth of our being. It is the one thing that we can be sure will not mislead us. An unwavering belief in oneself destroys the greatest enemies of achievement, fear, doubt, and vacillation. It removes the 1,001 obstacles which impede the progress of the weak and irresolute. Faith in one's mission, in the conviction that the Creator has given us power to realize our life call, as it is written in our blood and stamped on our brain cells, is the secret of all power. Poverty and failure are self-invited. The disasters people dread often come to them. Worry and anxiety enfeeble their force of mind and so blunt their creative and productive faculties that they are unable to exercise them properly. Fear of failure, or lack of faith in one's ability, is one of the most potent causes of failure. Many people of splendid powers have attained only mediocre success, and some are total failures, because they set bounds to their achievement, beyond which they did not allow themselves to think that they could pass. They put limitations to their ability. They cast stumbling blocks in their way by aiming only at mediocrity or predicting failure for themselves, taking their wares down instead of up, disparaging their business and belittling their powers. Thoughts are forces, and the constant affirmation of one's inherent right and power to succeed will change inhospitable conditions and unkind environments to favorable ones. If you resolve upon success with energy, you will very soon create a success atmosphere and things will come your way. You can make yourself a success magnet. If things would only change, you cry. What is it that changes things? Wishing or hustling? Dreaming or working? Can you expect them to change while you merely sit down and wish them to change? How long would it take you to build a house sitting on the foundation and wishing that it would go up? Wishing does not amount to anything, unless it is backed by endeavor, determination, and grit. Webster's father was much chagrined and pained when Daniel refused a $1,500 clerkship in the Court of Common Pleas in New Hampshire, which he had worked hard to secure for him after he left college.
"Daniel," he said, "don't you mean to take that office?"
"No, indeed, father. I hope I can do much better than that. I mean to use my tongue in the courts, not my pen. I mean to be an actor, not a register of other men's acts."
Sublime self-faith was characteristic of this giant's career. Every child should be taught to expect success and to believe that he was born to achieve, as the acorn is destined to become an oak. It is cruel for parents and teachers to tell children that they are dull or stupid, or that they are not like others of their age. They should inspire them, instead, with hope and confidence and belief in their success birthright. A child should be trained to expect great things and should believe firmly in his God-given power to accomplish something worthwhile in the world. Without self-faith and an iron will, man is but the plaything of chance, a puppet of circumstances. With these he is a king, and it is in childhood the seeds must be sown that will make him a conqueror in life. If you want to reach nobility, you can never do it by holding the thought of inferiority, the thought that you are not as good as other people, that you are not as able, that you cannot do this, that you cannot do that. Kant philosophy never does anything but tear down. It never builds up. If you want to amount to anything in the world, you must hold up your head. Say to yourself continually, "I am no beggar. I am no pauper. I am not a failure. I am a prince. I am a king. Success is my birthright, and nobody shall deprive me of it." A proper self-esteem is not a vulgar quality. It is a very sacred one. To esteem oneself justly is to get a glimpse of the Infinite's plan in us. It is to get the perfect image which the Creator had in mind when He formed us, the complete man or woman, not the dwarf, pinched one, with lack of self-esteem or of self-confidence seized. When we get a glimpse of our immortal selves, we shall see possibilities of which we never before dreamed. A sense of wholeness, of power and self-confidence, will come into our lives which will transform them. When we rate ourselves properly, we shall be in tune with the Infinite. Our faculties will be connected with an electric wire which carries unlimited power, and we shall no longer stumble in darkness, doubt, and weakness. We shall be invincible. End of chapter 1.
Chapter 2 of He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orison Swett Marden. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Getting Aroused.
"How's the boy getting on, Davis?"
asked Farmer John Field, as he watched his son, Marshall, waiting upon a customer.
"Well, John, you and I are old friends,"
replied Deacon Davis, as he took an apple from a barrel and handed it to Marshall's father as a peace offering.
"We're old friends, and I don't want to hurt your feelings, but I'm a blunt man, and air going to tell you the truth. Marshall is a good, steady boy, all right, but he wouldn't make a merchant if he stayed in my store 1,000 years. He weren't cut out for a merchant. Take him back to the farm, John, and teach him how to milk cows."
If Marshall Field had remained as clerk in Deacon Davis's store in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, where he got his first position, he could never have become one of the world's merchant princes. But when he went to Chicago and saw the marvelous examples around him of poor boys who had won success, it aroused his ambition and fired him with the determination to be a great merchant himself. "If others can do such wonderful things," he asked himself, "why cannot I?" Of course, there was the making of a great merchant in Mr. Field from the start, but circumstances, an ambition-arousing environment, had a great deal to do with stimulating his latent energy and bringing out his reserve force. It is doubtful if he would have climbed so rapidly in any other place than Chicago. In 1856, when young Field went there, this marvelous city was just starting on its unparalleled career. It had then only about 85,000 inhabitants. A few years before, it had been a mere Indian trading village. But the city grew by leaps and bounds, and always beat the predictions of its most sanguine inhabitants. Success was in the air. Everybody felt there were great possibilities there. Many people seem to think that ambition is a quality born within us that is not susceptible to improvement, that it is something thrust upon us which will take care of itself. But it is a passion that responds very quickly to cultivation, and it requires constant care and education, just as the faculty for music or art does, or it will atrophy. If we do not try to realize our ambition, it will not keep sharp and defined. Our faculties become dull and soon lose their power if they are not exercised. How can we expect our ambition to remain fresh and vigorous through years of inactivity, indolence, or indifference? If we constantly allow opportunities to slip by us without making any attempt to grasp them, our inclination will grow duller and weaker.
"What I most need," as Emerson says, "is somebody to make me do what I can."
To do what I can, that is my problem. Not what a Napoleon or Lincoln could do, but what I can do. It makes all the difference in the world to me whether I bring out the best thing in me or the worst, whether I utilize 10, 15, 25, or 90% of my ability. Everywhere we see people who have reached middle life or later without being aroused. They have developed only a small percentage of their success possibilities. They are still in a dormant state. The best thing in them lies so deep that it has never been awakened. When we meet these people, we feel conscious that they have a great deal of latent power that has never been exercised. Great possibilities of usefulness and of achievement are all unconsciously going to waste within them. Some time ago there appeared in the newspapers an account of a girl who had reached the age of 15 years, and yet had only attained the mental development of a small child. Only a few things interested her. She was dreamy, inactive, and indifferent to everything around her most of the time, until one day, while listening to a hand organ on the street, she suddenly awakened to full consciousness. She came to herself. Her faculties were aroused, and in a few days she leaped forward years in her development. Almost in a day she passed from childhood to budding womanhood. Most of us have an enormous amount of power of latent force, slumbering within us, as it slumbered in this girl, which could do marvels if we would only awaken it. The judge of the municipal court in a flourishing western city, one of the most highly esteemed jurists in his state, was in middle life before his latent power was aroused, an illiterate blacksmith. He is now 60, the owner of the finest library in his city, with the reputation of being its best-read man, and one whose highest endeavor is to help his fellow man. What caused the revolution in his life? the hearing of a single lecture on the value of education. This was what stirred the slumbering power within him, awakened his ambition, and set his feet in the path of self-development. I've known several men who never realized their possibilities until they reached middle life. Then they were suddenly aroused, as if from a long sleep, by reading some inspiriting, stimulating book, by listening to a sermon or lecture, or by meeting some friend, someone with high ideals, who understood, believed in, and encouraged them. It will make all the difference in the world to you whether you are with people who are watching for ability in you, people who believe in, encourage, and praise you, or whether you are with those who are forever breaking your idols, blasting your hopes, and throwing cold water on your aspirations. The chief probation officer of the Children's Court in New York, in his report for 1905, says, "Removing a boy or girl from improper environment is the first step in his or her reclamation." The New York Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, after 30 years of investigation of cases involving the social and moral welfare of over 500,000 children, has also come to the conclusion that environment is stronger than heredity. Even the strongest of us are not beyond the reach of our environment. No matter how independent, strong-willed, and determined our nature, we are constantly being modified by our surroundings. Take the best-born child with the greatest inherited advantages, and let it be reared by savages, and how many of its inherited tendencies will remain? If brought up from infancy in a barbarous, brutal atmosphere, it will, of course, become brutal. The story is told of a well-born child who, being lost or abandoned as an infant, was suckled by a wolf with her own young ones, and who actually took on all the characteristics of the wolf, walked on all fours, howled like a wolf, and ate like one. It does not take much to determine the lives of most of us. We naturally follow the example about us, and as a rule we rise or fall according to the strongest current in which we live. The poet's, "I am a part of all that I have met," is not a mere poetic flight of fancy. It's an absolute truth. Everything, every sermon or lecture or conversation you have heard, every person who has touched your life, has left an impress upon your character, and you are never quite the same person after the association or experience. You are a little different, modified somewhat from what you were before, just as Beecher was never the same man after reading Ruskin. Some years ago, a party of Russian workers were sent to this country by a Russian firm of shipbuilders in order they might acquire American methods and catch the American spirit. Within 6 months, the Russians had become almost the equals of American artisans among whom they worked. They had developed ambition, individuality, personal initiative, and a marked degree of excellence in their work. A year after their return to their own country, the deadening, non-progressive atmosphere about them had done its work. The men had lost the desire to improve. They were again plodders, with no goal beyond the day's work. The ambition aroused by stimulating environment had sunk to sleep again. Our Indian schools sometimes publish, side by side, photographs of the Indian youths as they come from the reservations and as they look when they are graduated. Well-dressed, intelligent, with the fire of ambition in their eyes. We predict great things for them, but the majority of those who go back to their tribes, after struggling a while to keep up their new standards, gradually drop back to their old manner of living. There are, of course, many notable exceptions, but these are strong characters, able to resist the downward dragging tendencies about them. If you interview the great army of failures, you will find that multitudes have failed because they never got into a stimulating, encouraging environment, because their ambition was never aroused, or because they were not strong enough to rally under depressing, discouraging, or vicious surroundings. Most of the people we find in prisons and poorhouses are pitiable examples of the influence of an environment which appealed to the worst instead of to the best in them. Whatever you do in life, make any sacrifice necessary to keep an ambition-arousing atmosphere, an environment that will stimulate you to self-development. Keep close to people who understand you, who believe in you, who will help you to discover yourself and encourage you to make the most of yourself.
This may make all the difference to you between a grand success and a mediocre existence. Stick to those who are trying to do something and to be somebody in the world. People of high aims, lofty ambition, keep close to those who are dead in earnest. Ambition is contagious. You will catch the spirit that dominates your environment. The success of those about you who are trying to climb upward will encourage and stimulate you to struggle harder if you have not done quite so well yourself. There is a great power in a battery of individuals who are struggling for the achievement of high aims, a great magnetic force which will help you to attract the object of your ambition. It is very stimulating to be with people whose aspirations run parallel with your own. If you lack energy, if you are naturally lazy, indolent, or inclined to take it easy, you will be urged forward by the constant prodding of the more ambitious. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 of He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orison Swett Marden. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Education by Absorption. John Wanamaker was once asked to invest in an expedition to recover from the Spanish Main doubloons which for half a century had lain at the bottom of the sea in sunken frigates.
"Young men," he replied, "I know of a better expedition than this right here. Near your own feet lie treasures untold. You can have them all by faithful study. Let us not be content to mine the most coal, to make the largest locomotives, to weave the largest quantities of carpets, but amid the sounds of the pick, the blows of the hammer, the rattle of the looms, and the roar of the machinery, take care that the immortal mechanism of God's own hand, the mind, is still full trained for the highest and noblest service."
The uneducated man is always placed at a great disadvantage. No matter how much natural ability one may have, if he's ignorant, he is discounted. It is not enough to possess ability. It must be made available by mental discipline. We ought to be ashamed to remain in ignorance in a land where the blind, the deaf and dumb, and even cripples and invalids manage to obtain a good education. Many youths throw away little opportunities for self-culture because they cannot see great ones. They let the years slip by without any special effort at self-improvement, until they are shocked in middle life or later by waking up to the fact that they are still ignorant of what they ought to know. Everywhere we go we see men and women, especially from 25 to 40 years of age, who are cramped and seriously handicapped by the lack of early training. I often get letters from such people asking if it's possible for them to educate themselves so late in life. Of course it is. There are so many good correspondence schools today, and institutions like Chautauqua, so many evening schools, lectures, books, libraries, and periodicals, that men and women who are determined to improve themselves have abundant opportunities to do so. While you lament the lack of early education and think it's too late to begin, you may be sure that there are other young men and women not very far from you who are making great strides in self-improvement, though they may not have half as good an opportunity for it as you have. The first thing to do is to make a resolution, strong, vigorous, and determined, that you are going to be an educated man or woman, that you are not going to go through life humiliated by ignorance, that if you have been deprived of early advantages, you are going to make up for their loss. Resolve that you will no longer be handicapped and placed at a disadvantage for that which you can remedy. You will find the whole world will change to you when you change your attitude toward it. You'll be surprised to see how quickly you can very materially improve your mind after you've made a vigorous resolve to do so. Go about it with the same determination that you would to make money or to learn a trade. There is a divine hunger in every normal being for self-expansion, a yearning for growth or enlargement. Beware of stifling this craving of nature for self-unfoldment. Man was made for growth. It is the object, the explanation of his being. To have an ambition to grow larger and broader every day, to push the horizon of ignorance a little farther away, to become a little richer in knowledge, a little wiser, and more of a man, that is an ambition worthwhile. It is not absolutely necessary that an education should be crowded into a few years of school life. The best educated people are those who are always learning, always absorbing knowledge from every possible source and at every opportunity. I know young people who have acquired a better education, a finer culture, through a habit of observation, or of carrying a book in the pocket to read at odd moments, or by taking courses in correspondence schools, than many who have gone through college. Youths who are quick to catch at new ideas, and who are in frequent contact with superior minds, not only often acquire a personal charm, but even, to a remarkable degree, develop mental power. The world is a great university. From the cradle to the grave, we are always in God's great kindergarten, where everything is trying to teach us its lesson, to give us its great secret. Some people are always at school, always storing up precious bits of knowledge. Everything has a lesson for them. It all depends upon the eye that can see, the mind that can appropriate. Very few people ever learn how to use their eyes. They go through the world with a superficial glance at things. Their eye pictures are so faint and so dim that details are lost and no strong impression is made on the mind. Yet the eye was intended for a great educator. The brain is a prisoner, never getting out to the outside world. It depends upon its five or six servants, the senses, to bring it material, and the larger part of it comes through the eye. The man who has learned the art of seeing things looks with his brain. I know a father who is training his boy to develop his powers of observation. He will send him out upon a street with which he is not familiar for a certain length of time, and then question him on his return to see how many things he has observed. He sends him to the show windows of great stores, to museums, and other public places to see how many of the objects he has seen the boy can recall and describe when he gets home. The father says that this practice develops in the boy a habit of seeing things instead of merely looking at them. When a new student went to the great naturalist, Professor Agassiz of Harvard, he would give him a fish and tell him to look at it for half an hour or an hour, and then describe to him what he saw. After the student thought he had told everything about the fish, the professor would say, "You have not really seen the fish yet. Look at it a while longer, and then tell me what you see." He would repeat this several times until the student developed a capacity for observation. If we go through life like an interrogation point, holding an alert, inquiring mind toward everything, we can acquire great mental wealth, wisdom which is beyond all material riches. Ruskin's mind was enriched by the observation of birds, insects, beasts, trees, rivers, mountains, pictures of sunset and landscape, and by memories of the song of the lark and of the brook. His brain held thousands of pictures, of paintings, of architecture, of sculpture, a material wealth which he reproduced as a joy for all time. Everything gave up its lesson, its secret, to his inquiring mind. The habit of absorbing information of all kinds from others is of untold value. A man is weak and ineffective in proportion as he secludes himself from his kind. There is a constant stream of power, a current of forces running to and fro between individuals who have come in contact with one another, if they have inquiring minds. We are all giving and taking perpetually when we associate together. The achiever today must keep in touch with the society around him. He must put his finger on the pulse of the great busy world and feel its throbbing life. He must be a part of it, or there will be some lack in his life. A single talent which one can use effectively is worth more than 10 talents imprisoned by ignorance. Education means that knowledge has been assimilated and become a part of the person. It is the ability to express the power within one, to give out what one knows, that measures efficiency and achievement. Pent-up knowledge is useless. People who feel their lack of education and who can afford the outlay can make wonderful strides in a year by putting themselves under good tutors who will direct their reading and study along different lines. The danger of trying to educate oneself lies in desultory, disconnected, aimless studying, which does not give anything like the benefit to be derived from the pursuit of a definite program for self-improvement. A person who wishes to educate himself at home should get some competent, well-trained person to lay out a plan for him, which can only be effectively done when the advisor knows the vocation, the tastes, and the needs of the would-be student. Anyone who aspires to an education, whether in country or city, can find someone to at least guide his studies, some teacher, clergyman, lawyer, or other educated person in the community to help him. There is one special advantage in self-education. You can adapt your studies to your own particular needs better than you could in school or college. Everyone who reaches middle life without an education should first read and study along the line of his own vocation, and then broaden himself as much as possible by reading on other lines. One can take up, alone, many studies, such as history, English literature, rhetoric, drawing, mathematics, and can also acquire by oneself, almost as effectively as with a teacher, a reading knowledge of foreign languages. The daily storing up of valuable information for use later in life, the reading of books that will inspire and stimulate to greater endeavor, the constant effort to try to improve oneself and one's condition in the world, are worth far more than a bank account to a youth. How many girls there are in this country who feel crippled by the fact that they have not been able to go to college, and yet they have the time and the material close at hand for obtaining a splendid education, but they waste their talents and opportunities in frivolous amusements and things which do not count in forceful character building. It is not such a very great undertaking to get all the essentials of a college course at home, or at least a fair substitute for it. Every hour in which one focuses his mind vigorously upon his studies at home may be as beneficial as the same time spent in college. Every well-ordered household ought to protect the time of those who desire to study at home. At a fixed hour every evening during the long winter, there should be by common consent a quiet period for mental concentration. For what is worthwhile in mental discipline, a quiet hour uninterrupted by time-thief callers. In thousands of homes where the members are devoted to each other and should encourage and help each other along, it is made almost impossible for anyone to take up reading, studying, or any exercise for self-improvement. Perhaps someone is thoughtless and keeps interrupting the others so that they cannot concentrate their minds. Or those who have nothing in common with your aims or your earnest life drop in to spend an evening in idle chatter. They have no ideals outside of the bread and butter and amusement questions, and do not realize how they are hindering you. There is constant temptation to waste one's evenings, and it takes a stout ambition and a firm resolution to separate oneself from a jolly, fun-living, and congenial family circle, or happy-hearted youthful callers, in order to try to rise above the common herd of unambitious persons who are content to slide along, totally ignorant of everything but the requirements of their particular vocations. A habit of forcing yourself to fix your mind steadfastly and systematically upon certain studies, even if only for periods of a few minutes at a time, is of itself of the greatest value. This habit helps one to utilize the odds and ends of time which are unavailable to most people, because they have never been trained to concentrate the mind at regular intervals. A good understanding of the possibilities that live in spare moments is a great success asset. The very reputation of always trying to improve yourself, of seizing every opportunity to fit yourself for something better, the reputation of being dead in earnest, determined to be somebody and to do something in the world, would be of untold assistance to you. People like to help those who are trying to help themselves. They will throw opportunities in their way. Such a reputation is the best kind of capital to start with. One trouble with people who are smarting under the consciousness of deficient education is that they do not realize the immense value of utilizing spare minutes. Like many boys who will not save their pennies and small change because they cannot see how a fortune could ever grow by the saving, they cannot see how a little study here and there each day will ever amount to a good substitute for a college education. I know a young man who never attended a high school, and yet educated himself so superbly that he has been offered a professorship in a college.
Most of his knowledge was gained during his odds and ends of time, while working hard at his vocation. Spare time meant something to him. The correspondence schools deserve very great credit for inducing hundreds of thousands of people, including clerks, mill operatives, and employees of all kinds, to take their courses, and thus save for study the odds and ends of time which otherwise would probably be thrown away. We have heard of some most remarkable instances of rapid advancement which these correspondence school students have made by reason of the improvement in their education. Many students have reaped 1,000% on their educational investment. It has saved them years of drudgery and has shortened wonderfully the road to their goal. Wisdom will not open her doors to those who are not willing to pay the price in self-sacrifice in hard work. Her jewels are too precious to scatter before the idle, the ambitionless. The very resolution to redeem yourself from ignorance at any cost is the first great step toward gaining an education. Charles Wagner once wrote to an American regarding his little boy, "May he know the price of the hours. God bless the rising boy who will do his best, for never losing a bit of the precious and God-given time." There is untold wealth locked up in the long winter evenings and odd moments ahead of you. A great opportunity confronts you. What will you do with it? End of chapter 3. Chapter 4 of He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orison Swett Marden. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Freedom at Any Cost. Were you to decide to risk your reputation, your material welfare, your whole future, upon some great physical or mental contest which you could extend over a considerable period of time, you would begin long beforehand to train or discipline yourself for the decisive conflict. You would not, if possible to avoid doing so, go into it handicapped. Every person who is ambitious to make his life count, to do what is worthwhile, is entering upon just such a contest. In starting upon a conflict so grave, so significant, and which affects the whole future, the first thing to do is get absolute freedom from everything which strangles ambition, discourages effort, and hinders progress. Freedom from everything which saps vitality, enslaves the faculties, and wastes energy. To remove every obstruction from the way and leave a clear path to one's goal. No matter how ambitious a runner may be to win, if he does not train off his surplus fat, if he is hampered with extra clothing, or runs with feet cramped and sore, his race is lost. The trouble with most of us is that while ambitious to succeed, we do not put ourselves in a condition to win. We do not cut the cords which bind us, or try to get rid of the entanglements and obstructions that hinder us. We trust too much to luck. To eliminate everything that can possibly retard us, to get into as harmonious an environment as possible, is the first preparation for a successful career. There are tens of thousands of people who have ability and inclination to rise out of mediocrity, and to do something worthwhile in the world, but who never do so because they cannot break the chains that bind their movements. Most of us are so bound in some part of our nature that we cannot get free, cannot gain the liberty to do the larger thing possible to us. We go through life doing the smaller, the meaner, when the larger, the grander would be possible, could we get rid of the things that handicap us. Every normal man has a reserve power within him, a mighty coil of force and purpose, which would enable him to make his life strong and complete, were he free to express the largest and the best things in him, were he not fettered by some bond, physical or moral. You can tie a strong horse with a very small cord, and he cannot show his greatest speed or strength till he is free. On every hand we see people with splendid ability tied down by some apparently insignificant thing which handicaps all their movements. They cannot go ahead until they are free. A giant would be a weakling if he were confined to so small a space that he did not have room to exert himself with freedom. The majority of people live in a cramped and uncongenial environment, in an atmosphere which dampens enthusiasm, discourages ambition and effort, scatters energy and wastes time. They have not the courage or stamina to cut the shackles that bind them,
to throw away all crutches and props, and to rely on themselves to get into an environment where they can do what they desire. Their ambition finally dies through discouragement and inaction. I recall the case of a youth with artistic talent who let precious years go by, drifting by accident from one vocation to another, without encouraging this God-given ability or making any great effort to get rid of the little things which stood in the way of a great career, although he was always haunted by a longing for it. He was conscientious in his everyday work, but his heart was never in it. His artistic nature yearned for expression, to get away from the work against which every faculty protested, and to go abroad and study. But he was poor, and although his work was drudgery, and his whole soul loathed it, he was afraid of the hardships and the obstacles he would have to encounter if he answered the call that ran in his blood. He kept resolving to break away and to follow the promptings of his ambition, but he also kept waiting and waiting for a more favorable opportunity, until, after a number of years, he found other things crowding into his life. His longing for art became fainter and fainter. The call was less and less imperative. Now he rarely speaks of his early aspirations, for his ambition is practically dead. Those who know him feel that something grand and sacred has gone out of him, and that, although he has been industrious and honest, he has never expressed the real meaning in his life, the highest thing in him. I know a woman who, in her youth and early womanhood, had marked musical ability. A voice rich, powerful, sympathetic. She had also a beautiful face and a magnetic personality. Nature had been very generous to her, and she longed to express her remarkable powers, but she was in a most discouraging environment. Her family did not understand or sympathize with her ambition, and she finally became accustomed to her shackles and, like a prisoner, ceased to struggle for freedom. A songstress of international fame who heard her voice said that she had it in her to make one of the world's greatest singers, but she yielded to the wishes of her parents and the fascinations of society until the ambition gradually died out of her life. She says that the dying of this great passion was indescribably painful. She settled down to the duties of a wife, but has never been really happy, and has always carried in her face an absent, faraway look of disappointment. Her unused talent was a great loss to the world, and a loss indescribable to herself. She drags out a dissatisfied existence, always regretting the past, and vainly wishing that instead of letting her ambition die, she had struggled to realize it. Timidity also hinders freedom. Thousands of able young men and women in this country are ambitious to make the most of themselves, but are completely fettered or held back by an abnormal timidity, a lack of self-faith. They feel great unused powers within, struggling for expression, but dread that they may fail. The fear of being thought forward or egotistical seals their lips, palsies their hands, and drives their ambition back upon itself to die of inaction. They do not dare to give up a certainty for an uncertainty. They are afraid to push ahead. They wait and wait, hoping that some mysterious power may liberate them and give them confidence and hope. Many people are imprisoned by ignorance. They never reach the freedom which education gives. Their mental powers are never unlocked. They have not the grit to struggle for emancipation, the stamina to make up for the lack of early training. They think they are too old to begin. The price of freedom seems too high to pay at their time of life, and so they plod upon a low plane when they could have gained the heights where superiority dwells. Others are so bound by the fetters of prejudice and superstition that their lives are narrow and mean. These are the most hopeless of all. They are so blinded that they do not even know they are not free, but they think other people are in prison. If you would attain that largeness of life, that fullness of self-expression which expands all the faculties, you must get freedom at any cost. Nothing will compensate you for stifling the best thing in you. Bring it out at any sacrifice. It often takes a great deal of friction, of suffering, of struggling with obstacles and misfortunes, before the true strength of one's character is brought out. The diamond could never reveal its depths of brilliancy and beauty but for the friction of the stone which grinds its facets, polishes it, and lets in the light which discloses its hidden wealth. This is the price of its liberation from darkness.
Ask the majority of men and women who have done great things in the world to what they owe their strength, their breadth of mind, and the diversity of experience which has enriched their lives. They will tell you that these are the fruits of struggle, that they acquired their finest discipline, their best character drill, in the effort to escape from uncongenial environment, to break the bonds which enslaved them, to obtain an education, to get away from poverty, to carry out some cherished plan, to reach their ideal, whatever it was. The efforts we are obliged to make to free ourselves from the bonds of poverty or heredity, of passion or prejudice, whatever it is that holds us back from our heart's desire, call to our aid spiritual and physical resources which would have remained forever unused, perhaps undiscovered, but for the necessity thrust upon us. Unsatisfied longings and stifled ambitions eat away at the very heart of desire. They sap strength of character, destroy hope, and blot out ideals. They play havoc with the lives of men and women. They make them mere shells, empty promises of what they might have been. I do not believe that anybody in any circumstances can be happy until he expresses that which God has made to dominate in his life, until he has given vent to that grand passion which speaks loudest in his nature, until he has made the best use of that gift which was intended to take precedence of all his other powers. No man can live a half-life when he has genuinely learned that it is a half-life, said Philip Brooks. After we have gained a glimpse of a life higher and better than we have been living, we must either break the bonds that bind us and struggle towards the attainment of that which we see, or development will cease and deterioration set in. Even the longing to reach an ideal will soon die out if no effort is made to satisfy it. No one should follow a vocation except by inevitable compulsion, which does not tend to unlock his prison house and let out the man. No one should voluntarily remain in an environment which prevents his development. Civilization owes its greatest triumphs to the struggles of men and women to free themselves from the bonds of circumstance. No man can live a full life while he is bound in any part of his nature. He must have freedom of thought as well as freedom of action to grow to his full height. There must be no shackles on his conscience, no stifling of his best powers. Be yourself. Do not lean or apologize. Few people belong to themselves. They are slaves to their creditors or to some entangling alliance. They do not do what they want to. They do what they're compelled to do, giving up their best energy to make a living, so that there is practically nothing left to make a life. There are plenty of men today working for others who really have more ability than their employers, but have been so enslaved, so entangled and faculty-bound by debt or unfortunate alliances that they have not been able to get the freedom to express their ability. Can anything compensate a promising young man for the loss of his freedom of action, his liberty of speech and conviction? Can any money pay him for cringing and crawling, sneaking and apologizing throughout his life, when it is within his power to hold up his head and without wincing look at the world squarely in the face? Never put yourself in a position, no matter what the inducement, whether a big salary or other financial reward, or the promise of position or influence, where you cannot act the part of a man. Let no consideration tie your tongue or purchase your opinion. Regard your independence as your inalienable right, with which you will never part for any consideration. One talent with freedom is infinitely better than genius tied up and entangled, so that it must do everything at a disadvantage. Of what use is a giant intellect so restrained and hampered that it can only do a pygmy's work? To make the most of ourselves, we must cut off whatever drains vitality, physical or moral, and stop all the waste of life. We must cut off everything which causes friction, which tends to weaken effort, lower the ideals, and drag down the life standards. Everything which tends to kill the ambition and to make us satisfied with mediocrity. Multitudes of people enslaved by bad physical habits are unable to get their best selves into their work. They are kept back by a leakage of energy and vital force resulting from bad habits and dissipation. Some are hindered by peculiarities of disposition, by stubbornness, slovenliness, meanness, revengefulness, jealousy or envy. These are all handicaps. Others go through life galled by their chains, but without making any serious, continuous effort to emancipate themselves. Like the elephants or other wild animals changed in the menageries, at first they rebel at their loss of freedom and try hard to break away, but gradually they become accustomed to slavery and take it for granted that it is a necessary part of their existence. Then again, there are entanglements which retard the progress and nullify the efforts of many businessmen, such as debt, bad partners, or unfortunate social alliances. Comparatively few men belong to themselves or are really free. They go the way they are pushed. They waste a large part of their energy on that which does not really count in the main issue of life, spend their lives paying for a dead horse, clearing up old debts that came from bad judgment, blunders, or foolish endorsements. Instead of putting on speed and gaining on life's road, they are always trying to make up for lost time. They are always in the rear, never in the vanguard of their possibilities. An ambitious young man, anxious to do what is right, and eager to make a place for himself in the world, entangles himself in complications that thwart his life purpose and cripple all his efforts, so that no matter how hard he struggles, he is never able to get beyond mediocrity. Hopelessly in debt, with a family to support, he cannot take advantage of the great opportunities about him as he could if he were free, if he had not risked his little savings and tied up his future earnings for years ahead. His great ambition only mocks him, for he cannot satisfy it. He is tied hand and foot. Like a caged eagle, no matter how high he might soar into the ether, he must stop when he strikes the bars. The man who trusts everybody is constantly crippling himself by entangling alliances. He endorses notes, loans money, helps everybody out, and usually gets left. He ties up his productive ability and hampers his work by his poor judgment or lack of business sense. A most estimable man of my acquaintance was ruined financially by endorsements and loans which would have been foolish even for a boy of 15. For many years it took every dollar he could spare from the absolute necessities of his family to pay these obligations. Our judgment was intended to preside over our mental faculties and to help us discriminate between the wise and the foolish. That man wins who keeps a level head and uses sound judgment in every transaction. Whatever you do, do not get involved. Make it a life rule to keep yourself clean and clear, with everything safeguarded. Before you go into anything of importance, think it through to the end. Make reasonably sure that you know where you are coming out. Do not risk a competence, or your home and your little savings, in the hope of getting something for nothing. Do not be carried away by the reports of those who in some venture have made a great deal on a little money. Where one makes, 100 lose. There is no greater delusion in the world than thinking that by putting out a little flyer here and there, you can make a few hundreds or a few thousands. If you cannot make money in the vocation which you have chosen for your life work, and in which you have become expert, if you cannot get rich in the business whose every detail you understand, how can you expect that somebody else will take your money and give you a tremendous return for it, when it will not get your personal supervision? I know a lawyer in New York, now a millionaire, who had worked most of his way through college, and came to the metropolis an utter stranger, taking a little desk room in a broker's office near Wall Street, who at the outset made a cast-iron rule he would always keep himself free from debt and entangling alliances. By this inflexible rule, it is true, he often lost opportunities which would have brought him excellent returns, but he has never tied himself up in any transaction. The result is that he has not worried himself to death, but he has reserved his strength. Nearly every enterprise he has gone into has been very successful, because he has not touched anything unless he could see through to the end and knew how he would come out, even taking into consideration possible shrinkage, accident, and loss. In this way, although he has never made any very brilliant strides or lucky hits, he has not gone up by leaps and bounds, he has never had to undo what he has done, and has always kept in a secure position. He has gained the confidence not only of men in his profession, but also of capitalists and men of wealth, who have entrusted large sums to him because he has always kept his head level and himself free from entanglements. people know that their business and their capital will be safe in his hands. Through steady growth and persistent pushing of practical certainties, he has not only become a millionaire, but a broad, progressive, comprehensive man of affairs. Develop your judgment early and exercise your caution until it becomes reliable. Your judgment is your best friend. Your common sense is your great life partner, given you for guidance and to protect your interests. Depend upon these three great friends, sound judgment, caution, and common sense, and you will not be flung about at the mercy of adverse winds.
Chapter 5 of He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orson Swett Marden. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. What the World Owes to Dreamers. Once when Emerson was in the company of men of affairs, who had been discussing railroad stocks and other business matters for some time, he said, "Gentlemen, now let us discuss real things for a while." Emerson was called the Dreamer of Dreams because he had the prophetic vision that saw the world to be, the higher civilization to come. Tens of thousands of men and women stand today where he then stood almost alone. Edison is a dreamer because he sees people half a century hence using and enjoying inventions, discoveries, and facilities which make the most advanced utilities of today seem very antiquated. His mind's eye sees as curiosities in museums, 50 years hence, those mechanisms and devices which now seem so marvelous to us. Dreamers in this sense are true prophets. They see the civilization that will be long before it arrives. As it was the dreamers of 49 who built the old San Francisco and made it the greatest port on the western coast, so after the recent great earthquake and fire, when the city lay in ashes and 300,000 people were homeless, it was the dreamers of today who saw the new city in the ashes where others saw only desolation, and who, with indomitable grit, the unconquerable American will that characterized the pioneers of a half century before, began to plan a restored city greater and grander than the old. It was in dreams that the projectors of the great transcontinental railroads first saw teeming cities and vast business enterprises, where the more practical men, without imagination, saw only the great American desert, vast alkali plains, sage grass, and impassable mountains. The dreams of men like Collis P. Huntington and Leland Strafford bound together the East and the West with bands of steel, made the two oceans neighbors, reclaimed the desert, and built cities where before only desolation reigned. It was the persistency and grit of dreamers that triumphed over the congressmen without imagination, who advised importing dromedaries to carry the mails across the great American desert, because they said it was ridiculous, a foolish waste of money, to build a railroad to the Pacific Ocean, as there was nothing there to support a population. It was such dreamers as those who saw the great metropolis of Chicago in a straggling Indian village, who saw Omaha, Kansas City, Denver, Salt Lake City, Los Angeles, and San Francisco many years before they arrived, that made their existence possible. It was such dreamers as Marshall Field, Joseph Leiter, and Potter Palmer, who saw in the ashes of the burned Chicago a new and glorified city, infinitely greater and grander than the old. Take the dreamers out of the world's history, and who would care to read it? Our dreamers. They are the advance guard of humanity, the toilers who, with bent back and sweating brow, cut smooth roads over which man marches forward from generation to generation. Most of the things which make life worth living, which have emancipated man from drudgery and lifted him above commonness and ugliness, the great amenities of life, we owe to our dreamers. The present is but the sum total of the dreams of the ages that have gone before, the dreams of the past made real. Our great ocean liners, our marvelous tunnels, our magnificent bridges, our schools, our universities, our hospitals, our libraries, our cosmopolitan cities with their vast facilities, comforts, and treasures of art are all the result of somebody's dreams. We hear a great deal of talk about the impracticality of dreamers, of people whose heads are among the stars while their feet are on the earth. But where would civilization be today but for the dreamers? We should still be riding in the stagecoach or tramping across continents. We should still cross the ocean in sailing ships, and our letters would be carried across continents by the Pony Express.
It cannot be done, cries the man without imagination.
It can be done. It shall be done, cries the dreamer. And he persists in his dreams through all sorts of privations, even to the point of starvation, if necessary, until his visions, his inventions, his discoveries, his ideas for the betterment of the race are made practical realities. What a picture the dreamer Columbus presented as he went about exposed to continual scoffs and indignities, characterized as an adventurer. The very children taught to regard him as a madman and pointing to their foreheads as he passed. He dreamed of a world beyond the seas, and in spite of unspeakable obstacles, his vision became a glorious reality. It was the men who, a quarter of a century ahead of their contemporaries, saw the marvelous hoe press in the hand press that made modern journalism possible. Without these dreamers, our printing would still be done by hand. It was the men who were denounced as visionaries who practically annihilated space and enabled us to converse and transact business with people thousands of miles away as though they were in the same building with us. How many, matter-of-fact, unimaginative men who see only through practical eyes would it take to replace a civilization, an Edison, a Bell, or a Marconi? The very practical people tell us that the imagination is all well enough in artists, musicians, and poets, but that it has little place in the great world of realities. Yet all leaders of men have been dreamers. Our great captains of industry, our merchant princes, have had powerful prophetic imaginations. They had faith in the vast commercial possibilities of our people. If it had not been for our dreamers, the American population would still be hugging the Atlantic coast. The most practical people in the world are those who can look far into the future and see the civilization yet to be, who can see the coming man emancipated from the narrowing, hampering fetters, limitations, and superstitions of the present day, who have the ability to foresee things to come with the power to make them realities. The dreamers have ever been those who have achieved the seemingly impossible. Our public parks, our art galleries, our great institutions are dotted with monuments and statues which the world has built to its dreamers, those who saw visions of better things, better days for the human race. What horrible experiences men and women have gone through in prisons and dungeons for their dreams, dreams which were destined to lift the world from savagery and emancipate man from drudgery. The very dreams for which Galileo and other great scientists were imprisoned and persecuted were recognized as science only a few generations later. Galileo's dream gave us a new heaven and a new earth. The dreams of Confucius, of Buddha, of Socrates have become realities in millions of human lives. Christ himself was denounced as a dreamer, but his whole life was a prophecy, a dream of the coming man, the coming civilization. He saw beyond the burlesque of the man God intended, beyond the deformed, weak, deficient, imperfect man heredity had made, to the perfect man, the ideal man, the image of divinity. Our visions do not mock us. They are evidences of what is to be, the foreglimpses of possible realities. The castle in the air always precedes the castle on the earth. George Stephenson, the poor miner, dreamed of a locomotive engine that would revolutionize the traffic of the world. While working in the coal pits for sixpence a day, or patching the clothes and mending the boots of his fellow workmen to earn a little money to attend night school, and at the same time supporting his blind father, he continued to dream. People called him crazy.
"His roaring engine will set the houses on fire with its sparks," everybody cried.
"Smoke will pollute the air. Carriage makers and coachmen will starve for want of work."
See this dreamer in the House of Commons when members of Parliament were cross-questioning him.
"What," said one member, "can be more palpably absurd and ridiculous than the prospect held out of locomotives traveling twice as fast as horses? We should as soon expect people of Woolwich to suffer themselves to be fired upon by one of Congreve's rockets, as to thrust themselves to the mercy of such a machine going at such a rate. We trust that Parliament will, in all the railways it may grant, limit the speed to 8 or 9 miles an hour, which is as great as can be ventured upon.
But in spite of calumny, ridicule, and opposition, this crazy visionary toiled on for 15 years for the realization of his vision. On the 4th of August, 1907, New York celebrated the centennial of the dream of Robert Fulton. See the crowd of curious scoffers at the wharves of the Hudson River at noon on Friday, August 4, 1807, to witness the results of what they thought the most ridiculous idea which ever entered a human brain, to witness what they believed would be a most humiliating failure of the dreams of a crank who proposed to take a party of people up the river to Albany in a steam vessel named Clermont. Did anybody ever hear of such an absurd idea as navigating against the current of the Hudson River without sail? Scornfully said the scoffing wiseacres. Many of them thought that the man who had fooled away his time and money on the Clermont was little better than an idiot, and that he ought to be in an insane asylum. But the Clermont did sail up the Hudson, and Fulton was hailed as a benefactor of the human race. What does the world not owe to Morse, who gave it its first telegraph? When the inventor asked for an appropriation of a few $1,000s for the first experimental line from Washington to Baltimore, he was sneered at by congressmen. After discouragements which would have disheartened most men, this experimental line was completed, and some congressmen were waiting for the message which they did not believe would ever come, when one of them asked the inventor how large a package he expected to be able to send over the wire. But very quickly the message did come, and derision was changed to praise. The dream of Cyrus W. Field, which tied two continents together by the ocean cable, was denounced as worse than folly. How long would it take to get the world's day-by-day news but for such dreamers as Field? When William Murdoch, at the close of the 18th century, dreamed of lighting London by means of coal gas conveyed to buildings and pipes, even Sir Humphrey Davy sneeringly asked, "Do you intend taking the dome of St. Paul's for a gasometer?" Sir Walter Scott, too, ridiculed the idea of lighting London by smoke, but he lived to use this same smoke dream to light his castle at Abbotsford.
"What?" said the wise scientist. "A light without a wick? Impossible!"
How people laughed at the dreamer Charles Goodyear, who struggled with hardships for 11 long years while trying to make India rubber of practical use. See him in prison for debt, still dreaming, while pawning his clothes and his wife's jewelry to get a little money to keep his children from starving. Note his sublime courage and devotion to his vision, even when without money to bury a dead child, while his 5 other children were near starvation, and his neighbors were denouncing him as insane. Women called Elias Howe a fool and crank, and condemned him for neglecting his family to dream of a machine which has proved a blessing to millions of their sex. The great masters are always idealists, seers of visions. The sculptor is a dreamer who sees the statue in the rough block before he strikes a blow with his chisel. The artist sees a vision of the finished painting in all its perfection and beauty of coloring and form before he touches a brush to the canvas. Every palace, every beautiful structure, is first the dream of the architect. It had no previous existence in reality. The building came out of his ideal before it was made real. Sir Christopher Wren saw St. Paul's Cathedral in all its magnificent beauty before the foundations were laid. It was his dream which revolutionized the architecture of London. It was the dreaming Baron Haussmann who made Paris the most beautiful city in the world. Think what we owe the beauty dreamers for making our homes and our parks so attractive. Yet there are thousands of practical men in New York today who, if they could have their way, would cut Central Park up into lots and cover it with business blocks. The achievements of every successful man are but the realized visions of his youth, his dreams of bettering his condition, of enlarging his power. Our homes are the dreams that begin with lovers and their efforts to better their condition, the dreams of those who once lived in huts and in log cabins. The modern luxurious railway train is the dream of those who rode in the old stagecoach. Not more than 12 years ago, the horseless carriage, the manufacture of which now promises to make one of the largest businesses in the world, was considered by most people in the same light as is the airship today. But there has recently been an exhibition of these dreams in Madison Square Garden, New York, on a scale so vast in the suggestiveness of its possibilities as to stagger credulity. Half a dozen years since, this invention was looked upon as a mere toy, a fad for a few millionaires. 12 years ago, there was not a single factory in America making cars for the market. 14 years ago, there were only 5 horseless vehicles in this country, and they had to be imported at extravagant prices. Today, there are over 100,000 in actual use. Instead of being a toy for millionaires, the automobile is now being used in place of horses by thousands of people with ordinary incomes. This dream is already helping us to solve the problem of crowded streets. It is providing a great educator as well as a health giver by tempting people into the country. The average man will ultimately, through its full realization, practically travel in his own private car. In fact, this dream is becoming one of the greatest joys and blessings that has ever come to humanity. It was the wonderful dream and steel of Carnegie, Schwab, and their associates, together with that of the elevator creator, that made the modern city with its skyscrapers possible. What do we not owe to our poet-dreamers who, like Shakespeare, have taught us to see the uncommon in the common, the extraordinary in the ordinary? The divinest heritage of man is the capacity to dream. It matters not how much we have to suffer today, if we believe there is a better tomorrow. Even stone walls do not a prison make to those who can dream. Who would rob the poor of this dreaming faculty that takes the drudgery out of their dry, dreary occupations? Who would deprive them of the luxuries which they enjoy in their dreams of a better and brighter future, of a fuller education, of more comforts for those dear to them? There is no medicine like hope, no incentive so great and no tonic so powerful as expectation of something better tomorrow. Dreaming is especially characteristic of the typical American. No matter how poor or what his misfortune, he is confident, self-reliant, even defiant at fate, because he believes better days are coming. The clerk can live in a store of his own, which his imagination builds. The poorest factory girl dreams of a beautiful home of her own. The humblest dream of power. The ability to lift oneself instantly out of all perplexities, trials, troubles, and discordant environment into an atmosphere of harmony and beauty and truth is beyond price. How many of us would have heart enough, hope enough, and courage enough to continue the struggle of life with enthusiasm if our power of dreaming were taken away from us? It is this dreaming, this hoping, this constant expectancy of better things to come that keeps our courage, lightens our burdens, and makes clear the way. I know a lady who has gone through the most trying and heart-rending experiences for many years, and yet everybody who knows her marvels at her sweetness of temper, her balance of mind, and beauty of character. She says that she owes everything to her ability to dream, that she can at will lift herself out of the most discordant and trying conditions into a calm of absolute harmony and beauty, and come back to her work with a freshened mind and invigorated body. The dreaming faculty, like every other faculty, may be abused. A great many people do nothing but dream. They spend all their energies in building air castles which they never try to make real. They live in an unnatural, delusive, theoretical atmosphere until the faculties become paralyzed from inaction. It is a splendid thing to dream when you have the grit and tenacity of purpose and the resolution to match your dreams with realities. But dreaming without effort, wishing without putting forth exertion to realize the wish, undermines the character. It is only practical dreaming that counts. Dreaming coupled with hard work and persistent endeavor. Just in proportion as we make our dreams realities, shall we become strong and effective. Dreams that are realized become an inspiration for new endeavor. It is in the power to make the dream good that we find the hope of this world. Dreaming and making good, this was what John Harvard did when with his few $100s he made Harvard College possible. The founding of Yale College, with a handful of books, was but a dream made good. President Roosevelt owes everything to his dream of better conditions for humanity, of higher ideals, his dream of a larger, finer type of manhood, of better government, of finer citizenship, of a larger and cleaner manhood and womanhood. The child lives in dreamland. It creates a world of its own and plays with the castles it builds. It traces pictures which are very real to it. It enjoys that which was never on sea or land, but which has a powerful influence in shaping its future life and character. Do not stop dreaming. Encourage your visions and believe in them. Cherish your dreams and try to make them real. This thing in us that aspires, that bids us to look up, that beckons us higher, is God-given. Aspiration is the hand that points us to the road that runs heavenward. As your vision is, so will your life be. Your better dream is the prophecy of what your life may be, ought to be. The great thing is to try to fashion the life after the pattern shown us in the moment of our highest inspiration, to make our highest moment permanent. We are all conscious that the best we do is but a sorry apology for what we ought to do, might do. The average man is but a burlesque of the sublime man God intended him to be. We certainly were made for something larger, grander, and more beautiful than we are. We have a feeling that what we are is out of keeping with, does not fit the larger, greater life plan which the Creator patterned for us. That it is mean, sordid, stingy, and pinched compared with the pattern of that divine man shown us in the moment of our highest vision. It is this creative power of the imagination, these dreams of the dreamers made good, that will ultimately raise man to his highest power, that will break down the barriers of caste, race, and creed, and make real the poet's vision of the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. The Golden Age lies onward, not behind. The pathway through the past has led us up. The pathway through the future will lead on, and higher. End of chapter 5. Chapter 6 of He Can Who Thinks He Can by Orison Swett Marden. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Spirit in Which You Work. It ought not be necessary to ask a man if he likes his work. The radiance of his face should tell that. His very buoyancy and pride in his task, his spirit of unbounded enthusiasm and zest ought to show it. He ought to be so in love with his work that he finds his greatest delight in it. And this inward joy should light up his whole being. A test of the quality of the individual is the spirit in which he does his work. If he goes to it grudgingly, like a slave under the lash, if he feels the drudgery in it, if his enthusiasm and love for it do not lift it out of commonness and make it a delight instead of a bore, he will never make a very great place for himself in the world. The man who feels his life yoke galling him, who does not understand why the bread and butter question could not have been solved by one great creative act instead of every man's being obliged to wrench everything he gets from nature through hard work. The man who does not see a beneficent design and a superb necessity in the principle that everyone should earn his own living has gotten a wrong view of life and will never get the splendid results out of his vocation that were intended for him. Multitudes of people do not half respect their work. They look upon it as a disagreeable necessity for providing bread and butter, clothing and shelter, as unavoidable drudgery instead of as a great man-builder, a great life university for the development of manhood and womanhood. They do not see the divinity in the spur of necessity which compels man to develop the best thing in him, to unfold his possibilities by his struggle to attain his ambition, to conquer the enemies of his prosperity and his happiness. They cannot see the curse in the unearned dollar, which takes the spur out of the motive. Work to them is sheer drudgery, an unmitigated evil. They cannot understand why the Creator did not put bread ready-made on trees. They do not see the stamina, the grit, the nobility and the manhood in being forced to conquer what they get. No one can make a real success of his life when he is all the time grumbling or apologizing for what he is doing. It is a confession of weakness. What a pitiable sight to see one of God's noblemen, made to hold up his head and be a king, to be cheerful and happy and to radiate power, going about whining and complaining of his work, even deploring the fact that he should have to work at all. It is demoralizing to allow yourself to do a thing in a half-hearted, grudging manner. There is a great adaptive power in human nature. The mind is wonderfully adjustive to different conditions, but you will not get the best results until your mind is settled, until you are resolved not only to like your work, but also to do it in the spirit of a master and not in that of a slave. Resolve that, whatever you do, you will bring the whole man to it, that you will fling the whole weight of your being into it, that you will do it in the spirit of a conqueror, and so get the lesson and power out of it which come only to the conqueror. Put the right spirit into your work. Treat your calling as divine, as a call from principle. If the thing itself be not important, the spirit in which you take hold of it makes all the difference in the world to you. It can make or mar the man. You cannot afford grumbling service or botched work in your life's record. You cannot afford to form a habit of half-doing things, or of doing them in the spirit of a drudge, for this will drag its slimy trail through all your subsequent career, always humiliating you at the most unexpected times. Let other people do the poor jobs, the botched work, if they will. Keep your standards up, your ideals high. The attitude with which a man approaches his task has everything to do with the quality and efficiency of his work, and with its influence upon his character. What a man does is a part of himself. It is the expression of what he stands for. Our life work is an outpicturing of our ambition, our ideals, our real selves. If you see a man's work, you see the man. No one can respect himself or have that sublime faith in himself which is essential to all high achievement when he puts mean, half-hearted, slipshod service into what he does. He cannot get his highest self-approval until he does his level best. No man can do his best or call out the highest thing in him while he regards his occupation as drudgery or a bore. Under no circumstances allow yourself to do anything as a drudge. Nothing is more demoralizing. No matter if circumstances force you to do something which is distasteful, compel yourself to find something interesting and instructive in it. Everything that is necessary to be done is full of interest. It is all a question of the attitude of mind in which we go to our task. If your occupation is distasteful, every rebellious thought, every feeling of disgust, only surround you with a failure atmosphere which is sure to attract more failure. The magnet that brings success and happiness must be charged with a positive, optimistic, enthusiastic force. The man who has not learned the secret of taking the drudgery out of his task by flinging his whole soul into it has not learned the first principles of success or happiness. It is perfectly possible to so exalt the most ordinary business by bringing to it the spirit of a master as to make of it a dignified vocation. The trouble with us is that we drop into a humdrum existence and do our work mechanically, with no heart, no vim, and no purpose. We do not learn the fine art of living for growth, for mind and soul expansion. We just exist. It was not intended that any necessary employment should be merely commonplace. There is a great, deep meaning in it all, a glory in it. Our possibilities, our destiny are in it, and the good of the world. Why is it that most people think that the glory of life does not belong to the ordinary vocations, that this belongs to the artist, to the musician, to the writer, or to someone of the more gentle and what they call dignified professions? There is as much dignity and grandeur and glory in agriculture as in statesmanship or authorship. Some people never see any beauty anywhere. They have no soul for the beautiful. Others see it everywhere. Farming to one man is a humdrum existence, an unbearable vocation, a monotonous routine, while another sees the glory and the dignity in it, and takes infinite pleasure in mixing brains with the soil and in working with the Creator to produce grander results.
I knew a cobbler in a little village who took infinitely more pride in his vocation than did the lawyer, or even the clergyman, of that town. I know a farmer who takes more pride in his crops than any other person in his community takes in his calling. He walks over his farm as proudly as a monarch might travel through his kingdom. This true master farmer will introduce his visitor to his horses and cows and other animals as though they were important personages. That is the kind of enthusiasm that takes the drudgery out of the farm and makes a joy out of life, which to many is so dull and commonplace. I have known a stenographer, on small pay, who put a higher quality of effort into her work than the proprietor of the great establishment she worked for, and she got more out of life than he did. I knew a schoolteacher, in a little district 25 miles from a railroad, in a schoolhouse right in the forest, who took more pride in her work and in the progress of her pupils than some presidents of colleges whom I've known appeared to take in their duties. A girl who declared that she never would do housework, that she never would cook, no matter what misfortunes might come to her, married a man who lost his money, and she was forced to part with her servants and to do the cooking herself for the family. She thought she never could do it, but she determined to make bread-making an art, to elevate cooking and make it a science in her home, and she succeeded. No matter how humble your work may seem, do it in the spirit of an artist, of a master. In this way, you lift it out of commonness and rob it of what would otherwise be drudgery. You will find that learning to thoroughly respect everything you do, and not to let it go out of your hands until it has the stamp of your approval upon it as a trademark, will have a wonderful effect upon your whole character. The quality of your work will have a great deal to do with the quality of your life. If your work quality is down, your character will be down, your standards down, your ideals down. The habit of insisting upon the best of which you are capable, and of always demanding of yourself the highest, never accepting the lowest, will make all the difference between mediocrity or failure and a successful career. If you bring your work to the spirit of an artist instead of an artisan, if you bring a burning zeal, an all-absorbing enthusiasm, if you determine to put the best there is in everything you do, no matter what it is, you will not long be troubled with a sense of drudgery. Everything depends on the spirit we bring to the task. The right spirit makes an artist in the humblest task, while the wrong spirit makes an artisan in any calling, no matter how high that calling may be. There is a dignity, an indescribable quality of superiority in everything we do which we thoroughly and honestly respect. There is nothing belittling or menial which has to be done for the welfare of the race. You cannot afford to give the mere dregs, the mere leavings of your energies to your work. The best in you is none too good for it. It is only when we do our best, when we put joy, energy, enthusiasm, and zeal into our work, that we really grow. And this is the only way we can keep our highest self-respect. We cannot think much of ourselves when we are not honest in our work, when we are not doing our level best. There is nothing which will compensate you for the loss of faith in yourself, for the knowledge of your reputation for doing bungling, dishonest work. You have something infinitely higher within you to satisfy than to make a mere living, to get through your day's work as easily as possible. It is your sense of right, the demand within you to do your level best, to develop the highest thing in you, to do the square thing, to be a man. This should speak so loudly in you that the mere bread-and-butter question, the money-making question, should be absolutely insignificant in comparison. Start out with a tacit understanding with yourself that you will be a man at all hazards, that your work shall express the highest and best things in you, and that you cannot afford to debase or demoralize yourself by appealing to the lowest, the most despicable, mean side of yourself by deteriorating, by botching your work. How often we see people working along without purpose, half committed to their aim, only intending to pursue their vocation until they strike snags. They intend to keep at it as long as it is tolerable, or until they find something they like better. This is a cowardly way to face a life work which determines our destiny.
A man ought to approach his life task, however humble, with the high ideals that characterize a great master as he approaches the canvas upon which he is going to put his masterpiece, with a resolution to make no false moves that will mar the model that lives in his ideal. A sacred thing, this approaching the uncut marble of life. We cannot afford to strike any false blows which might mar the angle that sleeps in the stone, for the image we produce must represent our life work. Whether it is beautiful or hideous, divine or brutal, it must stand as an expression of ourselves, as representing our ideals. It always pains me to see a young person approaching his life work with carelessness and indifference, as though it did not make much difference to him how he did his work if he only got through with it and got his pay for it. How little the average youth realizes the sacredness, the dignity, the divinity of his calling. There is a higher meaning, something broader, deeper, and nobler in a vocation than making a living or seeking fame. Making a life is the best thing in it. It should be a man developer, a character builder, and a great life school for broadening, deepening, and rounding into symmetry, harmony, and beauty all the God-given faculties within us. The part of our life work which gives us a living, which provides the bread and butter and clothes and houses and shelter, is merely incidental to the great disciplinary, educative phase of it, the self-unfoldment. It is a question of how large and how grand a man or woman you can bring out of your vocation, not how much money there is in it. Your life work is your statue. You cannot get away from it. It is beautiful or hideous, lovely or ugly, inspiring or debasing, as you make it. It will elevate or degrade. You can no more get away from it than you can, of your own volition, rise from the earth. Every errand you do, every letter you write, every piece of merchandise you sell, every conversation, every thought of yours, everything you do or think is a blow of the chisel which mars or beautifies the statue. The attitude of mind with which we perform our life work colors the whole career and determines the quality of the destiny. It is the lofty ideal that redeems the life from the curse of commonness and imparts a touch of nobility to every calling. But a low, sordid aim will take the dignity out of any occupation. End of chapter 6.